Universities in Illinois are watching as the Trump administration hints at broad changes in how it investigates race and ethnicity in college admissions. A former official from the Obama administration told NPR we could see civil rights law essentially flipped on its head in terms of who's protected.
It was civil rights laws that were aimed at ensuring that students of color and all students are able to access education in an equal way and to be able to have a diverse student body.
We'll find out how affirmative action plays out on Illinois campuses and what recent cases could mean for schools and students here ahead of application season. Plus, a small but growing number of primary care doctors want to serve their patients better for a price. And Illinois has sent volunteers and supplies to Houston to help physically rebuild and recover after Hurricane Harvey. We'll talk with a researcher who heads to Texas next week to help kids and teens deal with the trauma of natural disasters. It's all coming at this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. It's the first full academic year under the Trump administration, and many colleges in Illinois are watching closely as the Justice and Education Departments in recent months signaled a potential shift in priorities when it comes to race and admissions on campuses across the country. Last month, the New York Times reported the Justice Department was looking for investigators to take up cases that were widely interpreted to include accusations of discrimination against students who are white. Separately, a private lawsuit was filed against Harvard by a group of Asian American students. That suit claims that Asian Americans face a higher bar for admission than other groups like Latino or African American students. Joining me now to help us understand all of this and look ahead a little bit is Ebony's Imani Gallagher. She's professor of higher education and community college leadership at the University of Illinois. And also on the line from Washington, Scott Jasek. He's the editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Now, Ebony, why don't we start with you? I mean, many states, you know, and campuses have different policies when it comes to how race is or is not factored into admissions. Can you just kind of start in Illinois in general? What do we see from Illinois colleges and universities in that regard?
Well, you know, I think that when we talk about the retrenchment on affirmative action and the extent to which it's been contentious, it's been largely in terms of the elite institutions. And so the public flagships, Ivy institutions, and likewise in Illinois, there haven't been necessarily affirmative action lawsuits or claims.
Like we've seen in Michigan or Texas.
Like we've seen at the U of M or UT with the University of Illinois, let alone our comprehensive state colleges. But I do think that we're at a time based on, what's come to light in the last couple of weeks where Illinois, like its peer institutions, will need to have some documentation, need to really think about how they're documenting, legitimizing, making arguments and justifying their affirmative action program, similar
so
to how UT
kind of have a had. Different, it varies from campus to campus.
It can
from
vary
school,
from campus
to
campus.
College.
It can, you know, but I think the key term is, what do we mean by affirmative action? And it varies depending on who you ask. And, you know, from the onset, it was to provide a non-discriminatory society, to eradicate the previous discrimination of blacks and other minorities, and then over time got conflated with tokenism and reverse discrimination and the like. But, you know, by and large, affirmative action is really efforts to get rid of, you know, exclusionary practices, to foster inclusion. And so using particular measures that would permit the inclusion or consideration of gender, of race, national origin, disability, and so forth, you know, in concert, not in lieu of, but in concert with other criteria.
Yeah,
in
as
order
part of a
to,
larger approach.
Exactly.
And I would like to talk a little bit, you know, there's some data out there. I mean, the New York Times also recently put together an article showing, you know, how effective or not some of these policies are. But for a minute, Scott Jasek, just turning to you, you know, in a broader perspective, and what are you seeing across different campuses outside of Illinois around the country? How is race and ethnicity playing in terms of factor into college admissions? You know, and how different is it across colleges as you're seeing?
Well, it's very different, and it's mainly a factor, as you just heard, in elite college admissions. It's important to remember that most colleges do not consider race and ethnicity in admissions. Most colleges aren't competitive in admissions. And in fact, most minority students don't attend colleges that use race and ethnicity in admissions. If you care the most about the institutions where minority students enroll, you should be focusing at community colleges, at public, more open admissions institutions that serve lots and lots of minority students. At the same time, what happens at elite higher education is very important. The key, I think, is that the Supreme Court has never said, it's okay, just do it. They've said, it's okay if you have a clear rationale and a plan. Colleges need to show, whether they're in Illinois or elsewhere, colleges need to show that they have considered non-race specific measures and that they wouldn't work. Colleges have to show that they are taking steps to minimize the impact on those who don't benefit. And colleges get a lot of points, going back to a Sandra Day O'Connor opinion, in showing that they hope it won't be needed forever. That they don't view this as a long-term thing. So colleges have successfully, most recently the University of Texas, have successfully defended plans, but it took a lot of research and a lot of work. Where colleges may be vulnerable is if they haven't been doing that work.
So kind of, like, I mean, you're talking about the documenting there and having a process that's very clear and laid out. Scott, I mean, just what does that look like? I mean, can you pull back the curtain a little bit? You've done a lot of reporting on this and dug into the issue too. You know, if I'm a college admissions officer, what does that look like day to day through the admissions policy? How does it play into how I'm doing my job?
So generally, most colleges that consider race and ethnicity use what is known as holistic admissions. And in fact, if they want to consider race and ethnicity, they almost have to. Holistic admissions is, you don't have a formula that says this GPA plus this ACT score yields admissions. It means you're looking at everything. And that may include race and ethnicity, but it includes grades, it includes test scores, it includes whether somebody has overcome adversity of certain kinds, it includes whether they play the tuba and you need a tuba player, it includes their academic interests, where they're from. I mean, in a place like, in a state like Illinois, at your public institutions, I'm sure there are wealthy suburbs that send tons of students, and then neighborhoods in parts of Chicago or in rural areas that don't. There are lots of things to consider. And what you have to show with holistic admissions is that it is holistic, that you don't have separate standards. Where colleges have gotten in the trouble in the past is if they just give points for certain things, so they're not looking at the individual.
I see. Okay. So, and with all of that in mind, then, if that's sort of how the process is looking kind of on the back end, I mean, Ebony Zamani Gallagher, then in terms of the goals, I mean, what is the hopeful goal or end result of all of that work?
So I think the end result is to foster equitable student outcomes across diverse student groups, and we're still not there yet. So, you know, to Scott's point, part of how we get there is thinking about the student and the student's entirety, right? And so this holistic approach to how we admit our class and understanding that diversity has a compelling state interest for our campuses. And because our society, with the changing demographics, has never been more culturally pluralistic as to our campuses as a reflection of that, we have to have measures to have that diversity show on campus. But, you know, I guess I want to kind of go back to the point about the holistic piece and the tensions around affirmative action and what the DOJ is proposing to do from our understanding.
So to bring it back to the now, I mean, what are we hearing right now? What are you thinking?
Well, my understanding is that the Department of Justice plans to investigate, that there could potentially be some suits involved, the extent to which they deem intentional discrimination for certain groups. And the certain groups, namely, are white and Asian students. And so I think when we talk about has affirmative action worked and where do we see kind of the success, again, with elite schools, to the point of the recent New York Times article, there's been little to no change. But at the same time, that's only looking at flagship institutions. Mm-hmm. That's not looking at all of these other institutional types.
Just to let folks know, if they didn't see that article, there was they did a series of graphs that listed multiple schools, some of the higher level elite universities, including the University of Illinois, Northwestern, Illinois, among others. And it showed that even with affirmative action on many of these campuses, there was little, if any, and in many cases even declines in enrollment among African American and Latino students, and some increases in Asian students, if I'm getting that right.
Right. You know, I can make a parallel to that article with the University of Illinois. So in the article, it spoke to, for African American students, for example, that they comprise 15% of the freshman class, but they're only 6% of student college goers. So if you look at 15% of college age Americans being black, but only 6%, again, at these elite institutions. Well, Illinois, too, the total percent of African-American students is 6%. And so we see where there's still disproportionate representation when we disaggregate the data by race and ethnicity.
So, Scott, I mean, you had mentioned there, you know, you talked a little bit about what we're hearing from the federal government. Scott, can you kind of fill us in? What is the federal government's role in all of this? I mean, you know, we're hearing different things from the Trump administration than we did from the Obama administration. You know, as Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, you know, talked about changing or even ending, in some cases, Title IX protections for sexual assault on college campuses and sort of how those investigations are handled. When it comes to affirmative action, what role does the executive branch play, and what are you seeing and hearing that might hint at what's to come?
Well, here it seems to be coming from the Justice Department, not the Education Department. Mm-hmm. And one thing they could do is back the suit against Harvard that you mentioned.
And that's a student with the Asian American student saying that they were blocked.
The Asian American. And they very much want, generally, critics of affirmative action like to portray Asians as the victim, not white people, because mm-hmm. they, frankly, look better if they're advocates for another minority group. It is also the case that, on average, Asians' test scores and grades have skyrocketed. Just this week, ACT data came out in which Asians, on average, were exceeding white students and every other group. So, but I think it's disingenuous to say this is just about Asians, because if they question the use of race and ethnicity, mm-hmm. it will affect all groups. But what's interesting about Asians, if you look at California and Michigan, which California, which by referendum in the state, banned the consideration of race, what happened initially, big drop in black and Latino enrollments, and a surge in Asians, not whites. So people who think this will help white students are probably wrong. And that's because even in those states, they can still consider economic disadvantage. Which affects all groups, but includes Asian Americans. So I don't think you'll see that. In California, the Latino enrollment has gone up over time, but that's largely because the Latino population of the state has gone up so much. African American enrollment remains minimal, and also that is the case at the University of Michigan, which is nearby and also operating this way. I think if you want to talk long-term, as Sandra Day O'Connor encouraged, frankly, people need to be looking at elementary schools. People need to look at prenatal care. People need to look at the entire educational landscape. But the problem is, if you do that and you just eliminate all consideration of race now, you will see a big drop in the number of black and Latino professionals in American society. You will also, and this is a key part to the legal defense of affirmative action, you will also affect the education of all students. Mm-hmm. A key basis for defending affirmative action is that all students, white students too, benefit from being in an educational environment where everyone isn't just like them. And so you would see a real change in the picture. At the same time, it's early going. We don't know quite what the Justice Department is doing, but if they were to challenge Harvard, every college in America would take note.
So, I mean, let's bring that back then. So with those question marks and with, you know, you had talked earlier about some of the reasons that affirmative action came about, and Scott had touched on some of them. I mean, going back to prenatal care and certainly through educational opportunities, economic opportunities, the amount of trauma experienced through childhood and other things that go on through life, you know, they all kind of play into some of these questions. So at this moment in time, with so many unknowns out there, as a college campus, as a university campus, what kind of questions are being asked on campuses, and what sort of decisions have to be made to either prepare for or plan ahead for any potential changes that may be coming?
It's
I'm sorry, Scott. I was talking to Ebenezer Monty Gallagher.
Well, I think it's a situation of cumulative disadvantage and effects, potentially. Again, affirmative action was was enacted so that we could prevent exclusionary practices, that we could foster diversity. American institutions have never voluntarily sought diversity or valued it, hence the policing of the organizations through affirmative action. And so I think when we talk about what needs to happen, it's again, going back to Scott's earlier point with the holistic way in which we look at students in the admissions process is looking at gender, race, you know, ethnicity, national origin, all of these things in tandem with other criteria mm-hmm. so that we can improve conditions, you know, particularly for those that are qualified and have been subject to historical and present day discrimination. I think it's really ironic, however, or curious to me that affirmative action on one hand is pegged as something that is not working. Yet there's all this contention and heightened perceived threat, some of which I think is rooted in white privilege around being displaced. And again, kind of ironic that most of the affirmative action suits that have been brought forth in recent years are white women who have often been the beneficiaries of affirmative action. And so,
because
you know,
gender is included under affirmative
included.
Action, and we have
so
to rise in
take,
white
for instance, again, overall, Americans have been supportive of affirmative action. If we go back a few years, the 2009 Pew polls said as much, but it was when we talked about the framing of it. That's what's key. So if it's race conscious versus gender based or class targeted, then that's when the support for affirmative action really becomes divergent. And so white women have been no less oppositional to affirmative action than their white male counterparts if it's race conscious.
Ebony Zamani Gallagher, also talking with Scott Jasek. We're going to take a quick break here, but come back for just a couple of quick follow-ups on that and take a look a little bit ahead from where we go from here. You're listening to The 21st. And welcome back to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Happy Friday to you. We're having a conversation today as it's back to school season here, as many students are looking to start the application process. There are some hints, some early signs from the Trump administration that there could be some changes in the way that particularly the Justice Department handles issues of race and ethnicity when it comes to admissions in higher education. We're talking with Ebony Zamani Gallagher, professor of higher education, community college leadership at the University of Illinois. Also on the phone with us, Scott Jasek, editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. Just a couple of questions here as we wrap up. And Ebony, I'll turn to you. You were talking before about some of the legal actions on this. So we've seen cases, the Texas case, you know, which sort of upheld that as part of a holistic process that you could use race and ethnicity as part of an admissions process. In Michigan, there was a different take. The court upheld that a state could ban it in some cases of the use. So you can do it in certain cases, but you don't have to. So the court's sort of laying out some different parallels there. But a lot of this does seem to be ripe for lawsuits being decided in courts. You know, I've seen several over the years there. You know, why does so much seem to get brought up in the courts, and what impact could that have?
The good news is last year with UT Austin and their affirmative action plan being upheld, is affirmative action is still kind of the lay of the land, so to speak. And so diversity is a compelling state interest. In the case of Michigan, there were two different cases, right? The Gratz case as well as the Grutter case. And it was more of a split decision of sorts. So on one hand, there is affirmative action done wrong. You can't have quotas. You can't have set-asides. But there's also affirmative action that has that holistic admissions, mm-hmm. and you have very much demonstrated the criteria that you're using, where there's a litany of different things on the table for how that student body is brought in.
And there was a case I should mention, too. I think it was in 2006, Southern Illinois University. There was a suit there that decided they couldn't have fellowships solely for women and people of color.
Right. And so what we have seen is it also isn't just about college admissions, but it's the race-conscious forms of scholarships and financial aid that have also been contested. And Scott mentioned other tiers earlier. I guess I should also make a note that this is trickled down. People wouldn't necessarily think of community colleges and admissions and think of affirmative action being contentious given the open-door nature of the institutions. But with some of the high-skill, high-tech areas, nursing in particular, it gets contentious relative to admissions. And there was a case some years back relative to Camarena versus San Bernardino Valley where there was a suit that civil rights had been violated because a white female student was not allowed into a particular section of an English class that was deemed for the Puente Project.
So with, I mean, it's impossible to sort of predict the future in some cases like this, but as cases seem to be coming to the court, as you see this case come up with the Asian American students suing now Harvard, I mean, do you have any sense or any expectation as somebody who watches what goes on with colleges and hears from colleges and universities about what could be next?
I think more of the same. I think right now we have 8 states where we've had ballot initiatives. There have been referendums and affirmative action has been retrenched. I think under the Trump administration, that is actually probably going to occur. We'll have an uptick as we approach the next election cycle where we may see some ballot initiatives to have additional states ban affirmative action.
Like California effectively did.
And Michigan, yes.
Scott, I think we've only got a minute left here, but same question to you. I mean, sort of as you look at some of these cases and what's going on right now and some of these hints, as we said, out of D.C. right now, what's your expectation?
Right now, I would think it is the status quo, but those who care about affirmative action probably do well to pray for the health of current members of the Supreme Court. I think the replacement of Scalia didn't change things much because Scalia was very anti-affirmative action. But if there were additional changes from the justices who have supported it, who knows what we might see.
You can start to see the rollback of policies. Well, that's Scott Jasek, editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. Also in the studio with us, Ebony Zamani Gallagher, professor of higher education, community college leadership at the University of Illinois. Thank you both. I appreciate the time today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to the 21st. You know, more and more patients are choosing to pay upfront, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars a year, to get more personal care from their doctor. It's known as direct primary care, or in the higher end cases, concierge medicine. The number of doctors who've switched to this model is still small, but it's growing, and it's seen as a solution to, among other things, overworked doctors, frustrated patients feeling they're not getting the care that they would like or need. But it also raises some ethical concerns about who gets access to health care and how. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a direct primary care provider based here in central Illinois. But first, joining us now on the line to help us kind of learn more about this is Bridget Sweeney. She's a reporter with Crain's Chicago Business. And Bridget, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Scott. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote an article that kind of laid out a lot of what's going on, particularly in the Chicago area there. I mean, just to start, I mean, what exactly is direct primary care? How is it different than, you know, say what I might do now when I go see my doctor?
And so actually, that's a great question, but there's two different tiers that we're talking about here. There's direct primary care, and then there's quote-unquote concierge medicine. So both allow patients to kind of bypass the traditional headaches of working through a regular hospital system and their regular insurance company, which, as many listeners probably know, you know, requires making a phone call, getting an appointment for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks out, you know, getting shuffled around from doctor to doctor and not really seeing the same doctor again and again if you're in a big health system.
Mm-hmm.
So direct primary care and concierge medicine pretty much give you, it's like a personal trainer, but it's a personal doctor. You get the doctor's cell phone number. You pay them directly out of pocket. It's generally primary care, but they can refer you to specialists. They can come with you to specialist appointments. If, God forbid, you know, you have an emergency or a problem, they can literally, you know, get you, like, a, you know, in some cases, like a helicopter, or any, you know, if you're in a different country, they can go above and beyond to really get you both the emergency care you need and the long-term care if you're healthy or if you have chronic problems.
And so, I mean, those two tiers, and that's really important because, you know, I mentioned earlier tens of thousands. That's very much the concierge model, you know, and then there are others,
right.
You know, including some we're going to talk to here in a minute, that comes in at a much lower rate, in some cases, you know, $40, $50 a month. You know, but just
exactly.
Briefly here, you know, patients pay in advance here. Some services you mentioned are included, but this is not insurance, right? I mean, how does that kind of work?
Right. So it's absolutely out of pocket, and everyone in this world is really upfront about that. Like you said, the concierge world, it's the older version of this. It's been around since the mid-90s, and it started with a company based out in Seattle who they charge $25,000 per family per year, and every doctor only sees 50 families. So it's very exclusive, very high end. It was geared towards wealthy tech executives out on the West Coast. It's come to Chicago. However, in the intervening years, since the healthcare system has shifted so much and people are getting more and more frustrated and doctors are getting more and more overburdened, there's been lower end, but you can pay, like you said, $40 or $50 a month. And in many cases, that's the same or less than people are paying for their deductibles or for their co-pays.
Yeah.
So, some of these places are now beginning to work through insurance where you may still pay up front for the hour you see the doctor, but the doctor can try and route your blood work or your labs through your insurance. So they are beginning to try and work inside the insurance world as well, as everyone's just trying to kind of figure out how to solve the healthcare problem and how to make services accessible to people.
Yeah, accessible to people. Bridget Sweeney, reporter with Crane Chicago Business. I mean, it seems like a good moment to bring in James Chandler. He is doing this. He's a direct primary care practitioner, owner of Square One Healthcare in Champaign in Central Illinois. He joins me now here in the studio. James, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thank you so much for having us on today.
So, you know, you're using this model, a more affordable offshoot like than what she was talking about,
yeah.
The concierge model. But how... Take us inside from your perspective. I mean, you made the decision to shift into this type of a practice. How is your day different now than what it used to be before the change?
When I did family medicine, you would show up to about 28 to 30 patients on your schedule for the day. You were allotted 15 minutes for medicine checks, 30 minutes for physicals and new patients. And then you kind of spent an hour at the end of the day trying to catch up with everything. And you kind of got a little bit jealous of your employees that were checking the patients in because you felt like that they got to spend more time with your patients and what you actually did. Now the days are much more laid back. You know, we don't even have a clock in the office because we don't have people stacked up in the waiting room. And so we're able to just kind of talk about your family and your career and your life and really get to know kind of a whole person and not just kind of stare at a computer screen and just kind of, you know, base everything off of different kind of metrics that the hospital or whoever has kind of put in place for you for the day.
It's a little more independence. It's not like the patients get a little higher level of service. And you have a couple of hundred patients?
We do. Yeah, we have probably about 200 of adults and children.
And when you meet someone who's not heard of this before, of what you do before, how do you explain it?
Sometimes we try to liken it to the car insurance model. You know, if you needed an oil change, you don't call your car insurance company and say, hey, where can I go take my car for an oil change? Or if you have a flat tire, you don't typically call God forbid it was on the interstate, you need a tow or something. But typically you don't call your insurance for those things. And so we don't feel that your health insurance should play a role in where you go for a sore throat, for a simple cut, for, you know, a physical exam, you know. So we've tried to kind of circumvent that, you know, throughout my career between family medicine, emergency medicine, convenient care. We find there are three or four things universally. I think that, I don't want to generalize everybody, but I think people are upset with, and it's access, it's transparency, and it's time. And so we kind of feel like this model really helps to alleviate those things. It certainly doesn't fix everything, but we do offer transparency of billing, time, and access.
And we had mentioned before, so for that, I mean, and just briefly, I know we don't have a ton of time, but what does it cost sort of in your case, and then what is and what isn't included for people?
So most of your direct primary care settings are an age-based system. So ours are kind of $40, $50, or $60 a month, with kind of $35 being the lower cutoff and $55 being the upper. And then we say you can add kids to your plan for $20 a month.
Oh, I see.
And what that kind of includes is a personal number for myself and my partner is also Dr. Abraham, and who unfortunately couldn't be with us today, but I think he's out there listening. And and what that kind of gives is if, you know, like I wake up in the morning and I might have a text message where a kid woke up with crusty eyes this morning, and it's like, okay, cool, like we can get that taken care of for you. And that's free of charge. And if the things don't go as planned or if it's something that's a little more concerning, say, well, you know, we'll get you in the office today and that visit is free.
And oftentimes you can, you know, I mean, I'm just thinking from personal experience, you can call up your primary care doctor, and if you're not in a position like this, and that doctor's booked for the day and for the next week and for the next month.
And you end up with a walk-in clinic or whatever. Right. And so our patients typically get same day to next day access, which is all free with the process. And we also try and find different kind of value-based rates for things like lab and imaging. So like a cholesterol panel costs our patient $5.10.
Wow.
CBC, which is your complete blood cell count, is $2.90.
And one of the differences, not only the prices, but you know the patients know the price is coming in?
Exactly.
So
and
they can make some decisions.
They don't want, you know, sometimes people say, well, I have a great insurance plan and it should cover this, but if something gets billed wrong or coded wrong, all of a sudden you get that bill a couple of months later and you're like, where did this come from? You know?
Right.
So we help to kind of alleviate
clarify
that.
You know, one thing, I mean, obviously the cost and things and the transparency, and this is the cheaper than the concierge practices that we're hearing about before, but one of the criticisms of this is sort of an ethical concern. Are you pricing out people who can't afford to pay up front? I mean, what comes to mind, you know, would Medicaid patients be able to come to you, for example?
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't know exactly, you know, to generalize, I don't know what everybody's own financial situation is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because at the same point in time, the high deductible plans kind of outpriced a lot of other people as well, you know, whether it might be $400 or $500. So, but the Medicaid patients, like I said, we hope that we get in a situation where we can offer a lot of philanthropic services as well in case there is a group that we've outpriced that we can try and give back. You know, that's one of the biggest things of our model is that we invest in our patients, not necessarily in our clinic and those types of things, as we really try to invest in our patients and our community.
Interesting. Bridget, I mean, just as we kind of come up here, we've only got a couple of minutes left, I'm curious, you know, you've talked with many doctors, you've talked with, you know, some patients. For people listening and thinking that, you know, that either concierge medicine, which is the more expensive, in some cases much more expensive model, or in what we're talking about here, the direct primary care, it could be a good fit for them. I mean, what should they look for? Do you have any sort of advice, I guess, on figuring out, you know, who's right for this model and who's not?
Right. Well, Scott, I would say just having, you know, been to a few of these offices and talked to so many doctors, it's a pretty alluring, compelling model. I was actually thinking, you know, like many listeners, I'm sure, you know, we have moved to a high deductible healthcare plan, so I'm used to spending thousands of dollars every year on my healthcare, and so all of a sudden I'm like, well, if I can spend $3,000 a year and have this perfect white glove, really great service, why wouldn't I do it? Specifically, though, I do think, to answer your question, I do think people who are A, incredibly busy and travel a lot, and B, have maybe a chronic health condition that needs to be managed, I think they would do really well to go for one of these. You know, there's some kind of mid-level concierge services that offer a really wide array of, you know, you get your primary care, but you also get really hands-on referrals and like constant blood work and constant check-ins for about in between maybe $3,000 and $6,000 a year. And so if you have diabetes, if you have some kind of chronic condition, to me that seems like money pretty well spent and money that's not going to be much more than what you would be spending through a traditional health plan.
Sounds like it's a model that's growing and expanding too, so maybe opportunities for people will be more frequent. That's Bridget Sweeney, a reporter with Crain Chicago Business. We will tweet out and link to her, the article that she wrote all about this recently. Also in studio here, James Chandler, direct primary care practitioner, owner of Square One Healthcare in downtown Champaign. Thank you both for coming in today.
Hey, thanks so much, guys. Appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks so much.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, filling in for Nyla Boodoo here today. You know, we're watching today as Hurricane Irma cuts through the Caribbean, expected to hit Florida over the weekend. 2 weeks ago, Hurricane Harvey caused record flooding in Texas. Illinois has sent volunteers, supplies to Houston to help communities recover and rebuild physically. Next week, one researcher from Illinois heads to Texas to help residents, especially children and families, confront the intense emotional and social devastation of losing almost everything in a natural disaster. Tara Powell has worked in disaster recovery, helping children and families overcome trauma since 2005. After Hurricane Katrina, she co-developed a program called Journey of Hope, has since helped after hurricanes, earthquakes, other disasters in the United States and around the world. The University of Illinois professor will use that experience when he travels to Houston next week as an advisor with the aid group AmeriCares. Tara, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you coming in, especially before a big trip here next week.
Yes, it will be a big trip.
With everything going on. I mean, obviously, it's still early. A lot of uncertainty still at this point for how aid groups can best assist in communities affected by Hurricane Harvey. But, you know, when you arrive in a place, what are you looking for? How do you start to assess the need after something as big as a hurricane or an earthquake?
Yeah, so it really depends on the organization that I work with. I think it's pretty critical to work with an organization when you're going to do disaster relief.
And you can't parachute in and just start to do work. You've got to have an infrastructure and an organization.
Exactly. And so the organizations I work with go in right after the disaster. So there has been people on the ground. And they have pre-existing partnerships. So they work with their partners, see what their needs are. And usually that's immediate needs, housing, healthcare, food assistance. But then over the long term is where I really come in, and I work in mental health. So after the disaster is over, after people have gotten resettled, they start having mental health issues, stress, anxiety, sometimes post-traumatic stress issues come up. And so what I will be doing next week is going and assessing what is this immediate need and what are the long-term needs. So how can I build capacity within organizations?
And you talk about, mental health needs, in some cases PTSD. I mean, this is based on some work that you did, I'm thinking back after Katrina, some of the things that were, well, I guess I'll ask you that question. What did you start to see? What was happening in New Orleans that sort of pointed out the need for this type of work?
Yeah, so I went back to, or I was evacuated from New Orleans and went back in 2006.
You were at Tulane at the time.
I was at Tulane, yeah. And I went back in 2006, right when the schools opened back up, and we were working in the schools. It was pretty mass chaos. There were a lot of organizations that came in and wanted to do mental health programming, but they were really focused on children and adolescents who had clinical levels of distress, PTSD, were diagnosed. And really, they wanted to focus on processing the disaster and revisiting that. But what we found as social workers is that a lot of the children were having issues related to secondary adversities. So, yes, they had experienced Katrina. They had been stuck in the floodwaters, but they'd also been displaced from their home. They've separated from their families. There were a lot of children that we worked with who weren't even living with their families at the time. They were either in Houston or Atlanta.
Kids were still back in New Orleans.
The kids were in New Orleans, yeah. Separation. Yeah. The households had, multi-families living in there. So we realized that's what the children actually told us. That's what we want to talk about. We want to talk about all these other things going on. And we said, okay, let's talk about that. And so what we realized is there were different emotions that a lot of the kids were experiencing, a lot of anger, a lot of aggression, a lot of fear around hurricanes coming again, a lot of grief from losing not even just family members, but also pets and their house and life as they knew it.
And how would that play? I mean, for people who haven't been through a disaster like that, and that's probably many, who are listening right now. How does that play out? I mean, as kids, I mean, that's such a vulnerable time period. Those kind of fears already exist in some form. And then to have them play out on a daily basis right in front of you all the time, what kind of things did you see? What sort of actions or acting out were kids doing?
Yeah, so
with the schools in New Orleans post-Katrina, and actually with the schools in most post-disasters, things are pretty chaotic. In terms of acting out, there's an uptake in bullying behaviors. There's a lot of fighting. Mm-hmm. There's also children will experience anxiety around all sorts of things. So say, for example, in Houston, one thing that may happen is if they're back in school and there's threat of another hurricane coming or a big storm, they're going to experience anxiety symptoms. And having supports there for when that happens is really critical.
Well, that makes me wonder. I mean, there are many families who left New Orleans and fled to Houston.
I know.
So now you're heading to Houston.
Yeah.
How does that change the dynamic?
Yeah, I think in the coming months, we'll see a lot of families who experienced both Katrina and now Harvey. And I think that's definitely going to be something that will need to be addressed with the kids that we work with.
So more than 80,000, if I get the number right here, children have benefited from when this kind of became part of the Journey of Hope program.
Yeah.
And that's a unique, specific thing that's not mm-hmm. exactly what you're looking at in Houston this time. But where else this has been used after earthquakes, I understand, in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And what other contexts have you sort of taken this on in?
Yeah, so the program, which is housed under Save the Children, they distribute it all over the world now. I never would have thought, as a social worker post-Katrina, been such a big program. But it's been done in both post-disaster settings, in a number of areas domestically, so tornadoes in Alabama and mm-hmm. Oklahoma. It's also been used in Ukraine in a post-conflict setting, in New Zealand in response to earthquakes, in the UK in response to, it actually is more of a preventive intervention, so something that can help mitigate distress symptoms if a disaster did happen. So it's been, and it's also being done in Spain right now with children who were affected by the Syrian crisis.
So those are very different sort of aspects. You mentioned sort of conflict areas, natural disasters, some things man-made, some things nature-made, some more controllable than others. But for kids, none of it really controllable, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Are there different approaches that you have to take into consideration?
Well, it definitely has to be adapted culturally to the context. So there are some areas that really don't relate, some like issues that we talk about or emotions we talk about or concepts we talk about that don't really relate across cultures. So self-esteem is one thing. That's not actually a term that's used all over the world. Mm-hmm. So we've had to adapt it to fit within that context. But the thing with the program is we focus on emotions everybody has. So everybody experiences anger. So it's a pretty easy thing to get kids to talk about. And what we do is we try to normalize those emotions. So if the child says, we say, how do you express your anger? They'll say, yeah, I express it this way. And we'll say, it's normal to feel angry. But we try to equip them with healthy coping strategies to maybe if they're having like a behavioral dysregulation, to actually regulate those emotions a little bit more.
So normalizing in terms of being able to talk about them, confront them, realize that everybody kind of goes through this in some form and that's okay.
Absolutely.
And then teach them, give them the tools to kind of talk and process through that. We've talked a lot about children, but obviously you've talked about refugees, families, mm-hmm. parents, adults who have also benefited from this program. As you help some of the adults and the educators even through this process, what are you giving them? What sort of tools do you give them to help with some of the younger folks as well?
Yeah, so they're actually critical to the children's recovery. So we, within the Save the Children program, Journey of Hope, we also work with teachers we talk about their own stressors. So post-Katrina, the teachers and the parents came up and they said, this is great, you have programs for children, but we're stressed out. We're displaced from our houses.
And if the grown-ups are stressed out, the kids are
exactly
picking up on that right away.
Yeah, there's a direct correlation with children being able to recover with how their parents and their school systems are recovering. So the adult programming that I work with focuses on identifying stressors, coping with stressors. And then we also have a psychoeducational component on what children's common reactions to stress are and how to support the children.
So to recognize them and be able to give the support that's needed.
Yeah, Because one thing that we really found within the schools post-Katrina is a lot of the teachers would label the kids bad kids because they were acting out. Really, a lot of the reasons children were acting out is because they had incredible stressors that they were facing.
Right. So that's an interesting question then, because there's a lot of attention paid right after disaster, and then it may fade. The help sort of fades, and other things go away, and it sort of becomes a bit more of a distant memory. How long, should feelings of anger, of anxiety, intensely anyway, linger after disaster? And, if parents, if educators are dealing with a kid who is acting out and maybe wants to sleep in their room all the time or whatever, when does there come a point, I guess, when you have to kind of ease out or say enough or change the dynamic there?
Yeah, so I've actually had so many people ask me, when is the disaster over?
When is it over?
Yeah. When I was in New Zealand, with the earthquake there, a lot of the children would want to sleep with their parents because there were a few, and one happened at night and one happened when they were in school.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents come up and they would say, when is it not okay for my child to sleep with me? And first of all, if the child is exhibiting like extreme anxiety or extreme depression is very, very clingy to the parents for an extended period of time, then they should probably get additional help and support. But it's normal for children right after a disaster. And until things start to become normal again, you're back in a solid place. The child is in a school. They're not going to change schools four or five more times. When things start to get back to routine, if the child isn't doing better, then that's a time to get some additional help.
Does media in exposure to other, things are happening all the time. I'm thinking right now Harvey came through, and obviously you got Irma coming through, and it's if I'm experiencing one thing and just starting to sort of get a handle on it and get back to maybe some sense of normal and something else happens, I'm watching that play out all the time in the media.
Mm-hmm.
Does that play a role in any sense too?
Yeah, so the media is actually can be very harmful. If children watch it too much. So if parents have it going on, say, for example, CNN in the background all the time, children are going to be aware of that. And so limiting the media is very important, but also letting them know what's going on. So there's a very fine balance with telling your children, this is what's going on. We're working to keep you safe versus having, a radio or a TV station go on over and over and over again, just replaying new disasters. Say they just went through Harvey and then Irma's coming. And then there's another hurricane out.
There's always a next one.
There was an earthquake last night in Mexico. And so, kind of limiting that exposure is important.
Of all the experience, all those locations you've talked about helping all of those people, are there stories, are there examples, are there moments that stand out to you as examples of things where you know you made a difference?
Yeah, so I do remember, I'm thinking about Katrina, there was a little boy that I worked with, and he was about 5 years old. He had been stuck in the floodwaters. He had been displaced. His parents were his father was in Atlanta, his mother was back in New Orleans, and he came to me and he was so terrified and so scared. And with children that age, talk therapy doesn't really work. And so we worked through some arts-based approaches, and he was able to draw what he was going through. And over the months that I worked with him, you could see him start to come out of his shell. He wasn't as scared within the classroom.
Wow.
He was able to talk a little bit more and verbalize his feelings. And so that was a great experience that I had with him.
And just seeing that play out, right in front of your eyes like that, and that's not uncommon where kids cannot put voice to it. They have to find other methods.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that we have to realize, especially with younger children, with adolescents, they're fine having their voice heard. But and it can be really helpful to have them talk about their experiences because they like to. But with the younger children especially, we can't expect that they're able to verbalize what they've went through.
Yeah. So we've only got about a minute left here, but are there places people can go? Are there resources that people should be aware of when it comes to whether they're in a disaster zone or outside of it and the kids are just sort of paying attention? Are there tools?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different organizations that have tools for children. There's tip sheets. So the Save the Children website has some tip sheets that can help parents support their children. And FEMA and different organizations have tons of resources available. So I would recommend, with the internet these days, There's so many resources, mm-hmm. and you can find them all over the place.
Okay, and we'll tweet out also our earlier conversation with the American Academy of Pediatrics about a very similar conversation, but looking at some of the books and examples of how to sort of maybe guide, mm-hmm. you know, have a guided conversation for children. Just in 10 seconds here, when do you leave for Texas? How long do you expect to be there?
So I'm going to leave on Wednesday. I'll be there for about 2 weeks. I'll come back. I have to teach, so I have a class on child trauma that I'm teaching. And then I'll probably go back a few times during the recovery process and work there.
And check back. Mm-hmm. Well, good luck. It's Tara Powell, University of Illinois, professor of social work, joined us here in the studio, leaving for Houston after Hurricane Harvey next week to implement all the work that she just talked about right here. Thank you again.
Thank you.
That's all the time that we have here today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st, also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, and Robert Holly. Technical direction engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. I'm Scott Cameron. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.